look through the window of the original Joe's on North Beach and you'll see two guys at the counter talking ball. Time for you to listen in to their conversation. Marty Lurie and the SF Chronicles' Bruce Jenkins are looking through the window of baseball. Sponsored by Original Joe's of North Beach and Westlake on KNBR 104.5 and 680, the sports leader.
All right, nice to have you back with us. Bill Lasky is here as Bruce Jenkins joins us. Bruce, how are you?
Good, Marty. How you doing?
Well, we're doing well. As I say, you know, these shows start and we start talking, and Bruce, before you know it, an hour and a half goes by, and what happened?
Well, you know, that's how it should be. I mean, it wasn't always the case during a real season when they've just lost 10-2 and you're trying to fill 3 hours, you know?
You know, it's so true. This is so much more fun, I must tell you. But it's kind of a crazy time. One thing I did want to mention, we have a beautiful poet in as one of our fans, Elizabeth Chapman, and she's got a new poem collection coming out. It's called Midnight Exhibition at the Wheatgrass Saloon. And Bruce, it sounds like something you'd name.
I've been there. I had the wheatgrass special.
Really, the tomato juice. You get it from the Orchard Street Press, P.O. Box 280, Gates Mills, Ohio 44040. And if you'd like more information, you can email me, marty@kmbr.com. But Elizabeth did a beautiful poem about Game 7 of the 2014 World Series, and she's been on our show before, so I want to let everyone know that that is out there. But, Bruce, a little bit of Woe and I got into this with Bill about the plan, perhaps, if they're going to play baseball in Arizona or Florida, new divisions and all this kind of stuff. Your reaction to it?
Well, you know, Tony La Russa, who I think works for the Diamondbacks now, which is in Arizona, seems to be the center of all these new plans. He said, you know, we don't know if it's going to work, but we're trying. And if it does, it's going to be great. You know, I like the spirit of it. I mean, they're throwing stuff out mm-hmm. there and it kind of makes you think for a minute, gosh, you know, if this were to work, I sure would like to watch a ball game. I mean, for me, the whole idea of watching a game without fans is completely ridiculous. But the state that we're in now, I think we'd settle for it. I think it would keep your attention for at least a couple weeks. Maybe you get completely locked into it. I have no idea. But, you know, the reality of it is, I mean, there's just so many factors. You know, it's not just the ball players; it's the TV people and the media and the hotel staff and the travel. And one person all of a sudden tests positive. What happens then? And everybody who does, that's a 14-day quarantine. You know, what if you could go on and on with the pitfalls of this thing. The idea that it could actually work, it would be like a miracle if it were to work with where nobody got sick and the whole thing was televised and everybody had fun. But even then, you're talking about people watching all over the country and who knows what circumstances they're in. But, I mean, you know, testing is not that readily available. And there's been a lot of people suffering or even dying because of testing is not available. And all of a sudden you've got Major League Baseball with guys getting tested every 8 minutes. And that's not cool, even if it does work. So,
Bruce, Bill here. I want to jump in here a little bit. And, you know, we're talking about Arizona and Florida. Are they talking about how many games? Are they talking about what kind of schedule in quantity of games? And then the last thing that I read is they were going to say there was going to be a winner from Florida and a winner from Arizona, and then they go on to play the World Series. I think they're pushing that way too far so far.
Absolutely.
Marty and Ron and I both said is they got to get this on the ground before they start looking way down the road. And I think the key is getting them back on the field, getting them back into a spring training mode, and as we all keep talking about, getting them safe, making them safe, and making the people around them safe. Do you think down the road?
Yeah, exactly.
Do you think down the road is too far to look at?
Oh my God, I can barely read it. The Chronicle wanted me to comment on the USA Today report about the Grapefruit versus Cactus League, and my initial reaction was, really? I just threw that in the trash can. You know what I mean? Because, like you say, it's so far down the road. Who cares? You know, you're trying to sort out how many games they're going to play, and, oh, you know, well, the second seed's going to play the eighth. No, wait, the second seed's going to play the seventh seed. You know, nope.
Yeah.
How about nope?
Yeah.
Just,
now,
vaccine. You want the key word? The key word is vaccine. That's the word.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's the bottom line of this. So what people have to do, you have to think ahead. And there's nothing wrong with thinking ahead. You know, let's hope in maybe July or August or who knows when maybe that decision can be made. So
sure.
You want to be thinking ahead. But the bottom line is health and testing. And when that is straight and when people can feel comfortable, that's when you go forward. Because as Dr. Fauci has said and Dr. Birx, whoever is giving the medical opinion, you can't go backwards. You can't jump the gun in this
thing right.
And say, "Whoa, wow, we've contained it for 2 weeks. All right, everybody, let's go out to eat." You can't do it.
You can't do it.
And that's the big issue. It's okay to talk about it. It's okay to get all the reactions. That's fine. It's better to talk about it. But you can't do it until it's completely safe. And that's the bottom line.
Yeah, and everybody should be on the same page, whether we're out of work or we're lucky to have a job or we're a big league ball player or a legend like LeBron James or whatever. It's all about sheltering, continuing to suppress the thing and not saying that, hey, the numbers are good. Maybe we can get back. We can go back to work. Not really, you know, but there might be a day when we reach that point and then, you know, we can go forward.
Yep.
Well, I remember when Japan baseball tried to come back and a couple of people got tested positive and they shut down both teams for 14 days and they pulled back everything. And that was just more like their spring training. Now they're going at it a little different. Of course, Korea baseball is really going into the safety net of it. And I think those are two examples I think United States baseball really have to take a peek at.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't know how you guys feel about this, but the idea of, you know, everybody wearing masks and no fans and all these precautions being taken and just really a sense of fear in the air, which you can't shake until the thing is completely gone, that's pretty unsatisfying for me. I mean, I wouldn't, if I had the means to go to Korea, as much as I love baseball or Japan, I wouldn't, or even just go to Arizona and watch this new thing. I wouldn't be that excited about watching a game under those circumstances. Of course we want to see baseball. It would be great to sit back on your couch and watch anything. You know, but just no. I mean, the season, it's slipping away from us. It really is. And if nothing happens and they avoid something ridiculous that could lead to just more trouble, you know, I'm okay with that. We're starting to resign ourselves to the worst case scenario, and if it gets better, then that's great.
Mm-hmm. Well, I agree. I think we're all in agreement, and it's one of those discussions you hate to have on the air. But
yeah.
I think we're right. I think that's the truth of the matter, and I think we nailed it pretty well. The bright side of a little bit of this is that MLB TV is playing these games and showing these classic games, which are just fantastic. And I watched one this week, and I wanted to comment on it. It was the Red Sox and the White Sox, and it was Carlton Fisk's first game as a Chicago White Sox because he had his contract wasn't sent out in time. He became a free agent. He signed with the White Sox. But the interesting part about it, leading off for the White Sox, was Ron LaFleur. And then you had Fisk hitting third. You had Mike Squires hitting second, who actually was a left-handed member of the catcher. He had caught hit.
Yeah.
He threw left-handed. Mike Squires, known for that.
Yeah.
And Lisinski was the cleanup hitter. And there was a ground ball hit down the third baseline. And Ron LaFleur was the runner on third. And he was in foul territory. The ball was clearly in foul territory. And it was called foul. But what got me about it, two things. One, it was Ron LaFleur, who's got a great story. And, Bill, I know you want to talk about him a little bit.
Yeah.
But Ron LaFleur took the ball and threw it back to Eckersley on the mound. He didn't throw it out of the game, and Eckersley continued pitching. And I said, wow, I loved it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, what were we going to say about that, Bill?
Well, I think one of the coolest things, Marty and I talked about this week, and just watching some of the old games, the baseballs, the catching gear the guys had, they never framed pitches, and you know, back in the day when we all played and when we followed the game. And the best one was watching Ron Guidry against the Dodgers, and he's coming off the the mound, and the trainer's got his starter jacket ready to put on him. And these are all the different, you know, thoughts and patterns that we went through. And as an ex-player, I did the same thing. But the Ron LaFleur story is such a meaningful thing to me because he played for the Tigers, and I followed him also, a big Tiger fan as I was. He came out of prison and came right to the big leagues, and they scouted him in prison. And he came out, and he was a sensational player. And the biggest thing that he was, that he had speed. He was that leadoff hitter.
As anyone, like ever.
Yeah. Go ahead, Bruce. Yeah. Tell me a little bit about Ron LaFleur.
Well, yeah. I mean, he was a real good hitter, a good outfielder. But when you watched him run, especially considering that he'd been in prison, you know, it's not like he'd been training for the Olympics or the World Championship. You know, he comes out and he's already faster. You know, maybe Deion Sanders, I don't know, Willie Wilson or Willie Davis, but he was in that category, and you're just captivated by the speed, but also by his story. You know, the fact that he could come out of that circumstance and keep his dream alive and come into the big leagues and be just, you know, tremendously relevant. And I enjoyed watching those Detroit teams too. I got to cover some of it, and you know, stories like that are great. I've just noticed, you guys, when for readers, it just doesn't take much to perk their interest. Like I've been talking about baseball books, or they read a story from Osler or Ann Killian or Henry Schulman, whatever, and all of a sudden they email me with a story about, you know, one of their favorite games. You know, a guy told me about a game where he went to a game at Candlestick, and Willie Mays hit a home run that never left the ground more than 10 feet and would have been out on the, you know, in the San Leandro or something. You know, it's just like stuff like this, and that's what's keeping us all going. And it's the beauty of the game is that when you don't have anything to talk about right now, your memories can be very powerful, and if you unleash them and let them have life, it can be very, very therapeutic.
Mm. Bill, you would tell me that you played ball in a prison. Is that true?
Yeah, when I was in high school, and I was telling Marty this, I don't know how my parents let me do this. We made an all-star team my senior year out of high school, and we went up to Jackson State Prison where Ron LaFleur played, and we literally played the inmates. And we walked in, and here are all seniors in high school, this all-star team, and they throw us right in the middle of it. And, I mean, we got prisoners close to 5 feet from us, and we ended up playing them. And I was telling Marty in right field, they had the population of the gay inmates, and I was warming up, and I heard every slanderous thing you could say to me, from whistles to tell me how good my butt looked. But all the other things that went on to it, it was unbelievable. But, you know, I was also telling Marty Murphy used to give uniforms to the prison over here and let players use them. And it was something else. It was really a mind-blowing experience for me as a young kid. We ended up beating them, but, I mean, it was something else. And these guys were out for blood, too. That was their game. That was the game they wanted to play. And here's these all-star high school team comes up and beat them. But the Ron LaFleur story is something else. And, you know, I remember reading a book way back on Ron LaFleur. I think it was like From Prison to the Big Leagues or something of that magnitude. And he really talks about what he did in the prison and how he kept his mental game going and how many different things he did in drills and things. But he did really have a great story.
It's funny, when I was at Cal Berkeley, I covered every baseball game that they played for like 4 of the 5 years I was there, four and a half years. And in my senior year, they set up a game at San Quentin. So we're going over there, and we're going through all the intense security, and we're playing against the San Quentin inmates, and they're in the stands, and man, that was an unbelievable experience. You know, we weren't able to really tour the place, but we were very carefully placed out on the field in the stands for me, and at one point around the my friend Tony Murray, it was Jim Murray's son, had a no-hitter going through the fifth. And I thought, you know, Tony, I'm not sure it's a good idea to no-hit these guys. And I think the coach, George Wolfman, had the same thought. He pulled Tony with a no-hitter, and they brought in the guy who quickly gave up a couple hits, so much for that. But around the top of the seventh, all of a sudden, a bunch of guys set up a band about halfway between second base and the center fielder, just a full-on, you know, six-piece band with amps and everything. And it's like, what are you going to say, no?
I think the Giants used to play at San Quentin, and I seem to have that in my memory somewhere that I've read stories that that was one of the exhibition games they would play. Probably not in the last 50 years, but that was something they used to do. I remember they used to play Santa Clara. Remember Bob Garibaldi and Ernie Fazio?
Absolutely. Del Torbina.
Yeah.
Marty, I played Santa Clara, too. We played them out of spring training.
Did you?
Games. Yeah, we played Santa Clara.
They had good teams. Really good teams back then.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah, Bob Garibaldi was a pitcher. He got $100,000 from the Giants.
Yeah, I remember Rich Trotson and the Strain Brothers.
Yeah.
All you Santa Clara people are perking up right now.
Hey, later on in the show, we've got an author coming on, Mitchell Nathanson, and he wrote a book about Jim Boughton. And it does cover ball four quite a bit, and of course ball four, which I want to ask you guys about your opinions of it, and Bill being a former player, it'd be interesting to get his thoughts about it. But the book is very good. It talks about Jim Boughton, his life and who he was, and you know why he was the one who wrote ball four, which sort of is an expose of baseball confidences and clubhouses. But I want to get your thoughts about Jim Boughton a little bit and ball four. Bill, why don't you start off being the former player, and it sort of tore down the idols of Mickey Mantle and not drinking and all that kind of stuff. What do you think of ball four?
Well, you know, I read it in high school, and a buddy of mine gave it to him and said, hey, you love baseball stories, read this book. And, of course, I started reading it. And my mom came in the room, and she was like, what are you reading? I said, ball four, it's a baseball book. And she goes, okay. So I went to school the next day, and she ended up reading the first three chapters, and I got home, and she goes, what are you reading here? This stuff's all about drugs, womenizing. And I just remember my mom, I'm like, Mom, it's a book. Jim Boughton was a pitcher, you know. And it was just a funny thing from my mom reading three chapters and then drilling me about everything that I read. So, but I tell you what, as a young kid reading it, it opened my eyes, and this is Major League Baseball. You know, as you said, Marty, he really ripped on Mickey Mantle and all his drinking and all the womenizing that went on from bar to bar. And I remember a story where he said he was writing this book and he was in a bar and a lady he was talking to, he was talking about it. And she said, why don't you just call it Ball Four? And he goes, that's a great name of a book. I'll do it. So
definitely.
Jim Boughton really came out. He was really the first guy that came out that really, really told the inside what was going on in the clubhouse and all the different arguments he had with the pitching coach and the manager. And but I tell you what, he put some good numbers on as a pitcher in the big leagues.
Yeah, the two things that spring to mind for me is, one, I was at the Game 3 of the 1963 World Series, Dodgers-Yankees at Dodger Stadium on a beautiful afternoon. It was Boughton against Drysdale, and it was 1-0 Dodgers, and Boughton, his hat flying off on every pitch, was just godlike out there, and he had to be against Drysdale in that setting. He was absolutely phenomenal. I guarantee you that's got to be the highlight of his life. Even though he lost, it was the World Series, and he was mowing them down, and he had unbelievable stuff, which he didn't have for long, unfortunately. But and the other thing, yeah, you know, Marty, both of you guys probably remember Jim Brosnan, the relief pitcher for the Reds and other teams, wrote a couple of very good books. I think they were called Pennant Race and the Long Season, right, Marty?
Yes, exactly.
And they were a look into the inside of it, the clubhouse, and it was very revealing. Not nearly to the extent where, you know, Mickey Mantle's on a rooftop with a pair of binoculars or something, he's half in the bag, but he had sort of broken some ground there. I remember really, I was appalled by ball four at first. Because I was just starting in the business, I thought, oh my God, what has he done?
Yeah.
And you know, he definitely paid the price, but looking back on it, you know, it's a beloved tale, and it is pretty well done, and it's very funny. And of course, we all remember Joe Schultz's two words that he put together in reverse or regular order that just pretty much described everything. You can't say them on the air, but I mean, I still will say that to people. You know, like, well, that's, I'll tell you one word that sums it up right now. You know,
I think was the second word, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
But, and, you know, sports writing, I was going to ask you that, Bruce, because this is sort of a contemporary of yours. Sports writing had changed by the end of the 60s. Of course, the United States had changed going through Vietnam and the assassinations and everything else. And they called the new writers the chipmunks.
Yeah.
And they were the ones who got in there and got those kind of stories as opposed to overlooking everything. So how were you taught about covering baseball in those days?
Well, I was a devotee of the L.A. Times and you know, Jim Murray and the great they had a very distinguished staff, I thought, and they wrote to me what stood out about them wasn't that they were exposing stuff that shouldn't come out, but they were exposing the humor of it, the humanity of it, you know, what made players tick. You know, I watched Jim Murray interview people at Dodger Stadium, and they like cleared the lane for him. It's like they put him in the dugout with somebody with a lot of space around him, and the next day you'd read Jim Murray's column, and there weren't any quotes in it. He just wanted to get a feel for the guy, you know. And I just thought that was the way I wanted to go. There, I wasn't going to be Dick Young, you know, firing everybody and getting in there and having everybody pissed off at me. It's just not my temperament, you know. I felt like if I was doing a good job and writing stories that people thought showed some knowledge of the game and some respect for the game, I'd much rather have that than everybody on my ass, you know, because I was trying to be something, you know, special and controversial. So, I mean, that's kind of the way I went about it. There's a lot of ways to do it, heaven knows. And, you know, Dick Young and all the chipmunks that followed him. I wouldn't call Dick Young a chipmunk to his face if he was still here. But
he didn't like it because the chipmunks were getting the stories. And he couldn't use his old sources to get him anymore. So he
was, yeah, exactly. The chipmunks ganged up on him a little bit.
Yeah, he was out, which was interesting. The final thought on Jim Bowden was he did come back as a knuckleball pitcher.
Yeah.
In the late 70s and actually pitched against the Giants, the Dodgers, and the Reds. And he beat the Giants at Candlestick, believe it or not. And Bill Madlock, someone told me this, either you, one of you guys maybe, after the game said he couldn't believe he couldn't hit him. Because he had nothing but the knuckleball, and he actually beat the Giants.
Well, I'm trying to imagine, A, throwing a knuckler at Candlestick in the evening, and B, trying to hit it. I mean, the thing moves all over the place anyway, and now you've got the wind. I guess if you're throwing against the wind, it might be more effective. Who knows? But, I thought that was tremendous of him. I mean, you know, you hear about guys like Frank Tanana when they lose their stuff and they come back as kind of a junk baller, but they come back as a knuckleball pitcher. That's pretty amazing. He pulled it off just enough to where you had to hand it to him.
Hey, Marty, let me ask you a question about Ball 4. What did you think of it, reading it? And what did you think? Do you think these stories that he was throwing out there were true, or do you think they were fabricated?
Well, I'm a man of the 60s, so don't forget I went to law school 67 to 70, graduated early 71 because I was in the Army Reserves. So for me, I was part of, you know, the new culture of what was going on at that period of time. So being a person of the 60s, it was sort of in line with protesting and Vietnam and everything else. So I don't think I was shocked by it. But I was a reader, a loyal subscriber to the Sporting News from age 10 on, and I hate to tell you, I've still got most of them, and Sport Magazine, I've got most of them as well.
Wow.
And then to see this and read this, it was kind of, wow, I almost couldn't believe it. And but for me, in that period of time in my life, being in the 60s and being 24 years old, 20, you know, whatever age I was, being born in 1946. So it was sort of part of what was happening, I think. So it didn't shock me that much.
Yeah, I think at the time you had to wonder, God, is he making some of this stuff up? But as time went on and the book became more and more celebrated, I think it became apparent that they were true. I mean, you don't have any longevity in that if you're just making stuff up or exaggerating to the point of embarrassing somebody. I think he was telling it straight.
Yeah,
I really believe so, too. And I think he just took it upon himself saying, hey, there's so much stuff going on in these clubhouses. There's so many arguments between players and management. I just think he just wanted to put it off his chest and say, I'll be the first one to talk about it. But as we both talked about it, to put Mickey Mantle where he was and told about how much drinking he did, and we both, all three of us, know how much he drank, it was kind of obvious he was trying to put a dagger in his back.
Let me ask you this, Bruce, because you covered Billy Martin in the early 80s, and Billy had the trailer and the drinking. You've talked about that on the show before. Was that written about prominently, that Billy, you know, of course he'd had his fights by then with the marshmallow salesman, Dave Boswell, and everybody else. But was Billy written about in that way with the drinking?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, between us who covered him in Oakland and the writers in New York, it sort of depended where he was at. He pretty much was either on top of the world, and what are you going to say? He's managing the team with a brand of genius you rarely see, or he was absolutely going into the tank, and his players were killing him off the record, and he was doing a lot of drinking. Now, you know, for me and all of us as beat writers, in 80 and 81, the magic was really astounding with the A's. And we saw Billy do a lot of crazy things. We saw him get too drunk and leave the bar with whoever and curse across the room to whoever, one of his players, you know. But we all had a pact that we're not going to write it unless it gets on the police blotter.
Okay.
You know, then you have to.
Okay.
But,
yeah.
And I think what we were doing there, we were kind of going back to riding the train with Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig, you know. But to me, it made perfect sense. I mean, we're privileged to be in on this. And until he hits a police blotter, man, this is a guy who's making news across the country. He is the best manager I ever covered. This definitely the smartest during a game. And I'm sorry, but I'm not going to write about some after-hours incident until it becomes a matter of public record. And then in 1982, everything flipped. You know, he left the game early in Toronto. He got kicked out of a game in Toronto basically so he could just get a few early cocktails in. He'd go to Arlington. Every time we went to Arlington, he'd go visit Mantle in the middle of the day. I mean, God knows what's going to happen there.
Interesting. Boy.
Especially with Billy's teams in the tank. Yeah. One night he showed up at like 7:20, and Jackie Moore had already assumed that he was going to manage the team that night. And, you know, we couched it a little bit. I mean, we didn't spill it all out there, but it was just kind of apparent, you know. I mean, and you know, then we all started writing about how things were falling apart and how the players, he'd lost the players, and we're talking to them, and they're too afraid to speak for the record, but they're killing him off the record. And we're writing those stories, and one by one, whether it was Kit Steer or Glenn Schwartz or Bud Geraci or me, when one of those stories came out where nobody's copying to their own remarks and it's all off the record, he just friggin' crushed us for 15 minutes before we could get a word in, just slaughtering us. You sons of bitches, you know, that sort of thing. Just, I mean, and you wind up feeling like you're about 3 inches tall, and you kind of creep out of there like, Jesus.
Either, Bruce, you're stuck in his manager's office. You got.
Yeah, I know. I'm glad to get out of there alive. You know,
you got a book in there. You know that. There's a book in there.
Yeah, there's a book in there. Yeah, I'm still trying to do daily stuff, and maybe I do think about writing a book. Who knows?
It's good. It's great stuff.
Bruce. You got time now to write that book.
I know. You know, the funny thing is I really don't have that much time because I've got like 8 columns I'm working on in different stages, all about nothing, of course. You know, I'm just trying to keep the thing going, I kind of like it because my days kind of go by pretty quickly.
Oh, good. Well, one last thing before we let you go, and Bill, too. April 15th is coming up. It's not tax day. That's been deferred, thank God. But April 15th is Jackie Robinson Day. And, of course, we don't have any baseball, so we shouldn't forget it. And I hope that people acknowledge it, and I'll throw that out to you guys. Jackie Robinson Day this April 15th.
That's special day,
ahead,
no doubt about it. I mean, Major League Baseball has definitely put that on their top of the list, and I thought that was one of the coolest things they did of all the players and everyone wearing his number and really teaching the world about Jackie Robinson, especially younger players and, you know, all the different ages and all the different nationalities. Jackie Robinson was the guy. He was the one to make that first step forward. And all the other African-American players would follow. But he was just that dynamic person. He had so many skills, and the skill level that he put on the field was just obvious. He was one of the best, if not the best player, to put on that uniform daily. And I just love how Major League Baseball does that. And it should have been done years ago. It really should have.
It truly was amazing how he was that guy, and the genius of Branch Rickey to single him out and to sound him out. You know, what are you going to do when eight guys in the dugout want to fight you, or eight guys are calling you this, or just one guy or the other manager? And all that happened. What are you going to do? And yeah. when it actually happened, you know, at least in the first season, he sucked it up. He basically just tried not to hear it and just beat him on the field. But as we learned later in that great book, Bushville Wins, Marty, that you recommended to me, Bushville Wins is a great book about the Milwaukee Braves. But those guys, as Jackie Robinson got to be kind of a fixture in the league, guys were still on him. And he started fighting back and you know, really fighting, literally fighting. And it was just a great progression of him from showing the class and dignity that he had to show, not just to the Dodgers in the league, but to African Americans everywhere. Mm-hmm. This is how you get through a white man's world, okay? You suck it up, and you feel terrible, and you sort it out with your wife, who, by the way, was one of the greatest sports wives in the history of man. You know, it's real sturdy block behind him. And then, you know, once you get your footing in and people respect you and they come out to see you play, you can let a little more of yourself out.
Mm, what a story. Yeah. Thank God Judge Landis died in November of 1940. Really?
Yeah.
Another That's 10 years line, of him. Buddy. Really, another 10 years of him. Who knows what would have happened.
Oh,
but November of 44, he died. And then we saw things were going to happen. That was the deal.
That was a big
Holy
death.
Cow.
Very, very big death in our history.
Very important. Yeah. Really, really. People forget
very
that.
But
once he died, Branch Rickey and the laws sort of changed in New York against discrimination. Branch Rickey got the idea, okay, well, now I see where we're going, and he had the vision to do it.
Yeah.
And the Yankees wouldn't do it, you know, until 1954, and the Giants, Horace Stoneham, got involved, but, you know, a year later. So
it's amazing to think about some of the thought processes back then. When Bobby Mitchell died, a great NFL football player, in 1962, he was traded to the Washington Redskins. We don't use Redskins in print, which I definitely understand. But and the owner of the team, George Preston Marshall, had actually come out saying, "I would rather not have black players on my team." Mm-hmm. I would rather have, I mean, this is clearly where he was at. He was the last team to integrate, sort of the Pumpsy Green of NFL. You know, and Bobby Mitchell faced those same kinds of things that Jackie Robinson did, and he conducted himself in exactly the same way, became a Hall of Famer, and set standards that everyone in black or white should follow in their lives. But, man, it was just the obstacles they had to face back then are just titanic.
George Weiss was the same way with the Yankees, the general manager. You know, oh, boy, we could do. Well, you know, Bruce, you and I have done these shows each year. We've always talked about Jackie Robinson. So I'm glad we had a chance to do it tonight. Boy, thanks for spending a Saturday night with us. That was good.
Hey, I tell you, I look forward to these Saturday nights, you guys. It's really it's great. You never know where it's going to go, but hopefully it's working.
Yeah, it's fun. All right, take care. We'll talk to you next Saturday. Thanks, Bruce.
Sounds great. See you guys.
All right. Boy, Bill, this is another one. 2 hours just goes by
so quickly. Yeah, Marty, I tell you what, the stories, and I love how the avenues, they just wind into something else, or the story goes into something else. I just love that, and it's great baseball talk, and, you know, Bruce and Woe were fabulous, and of course, you as a host directing it. I have fun every time, and I think you said manja when we first started. Well, that's hungry. Is that what it is? And that's
manja,
where I'm going.
Manja, manja, eat,
my dinner.
Eat in Italian. Call Original Joe's up. Call Original Joe's up. Do your takeout order. We've got a lot of those commercials to play, but Raph put a lot together. But, Bill, thanks. Have a great week, and we'll talk during
you
the week.
Too.
I appreciate it.
Yep, and thanks, Raph, for directing us. And, again, Marty, you stay safe, Bubble Boy, and we'll catch you next week.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
See you, buddy.
All right. That is Bill Lasky. All right. Let's see. Whew. Take a breath for a second. We've got a lot more show coming up. All right. Kerry Crowley and Katie Wu are going to join us next. And it's going to be interesting. There's a new video game out on Raph, what is it called? On what do you call it? It's going to say Xbox, but I forget what it's called. But it's a big baseball game that's out, and Katie is into it. And Kerry, we'll talk a little ball with both of them. We've got Mitchell Nathanson coming up. We've got a great, great couple of deep segments with Ray Fossey coming up. And Mark A. Simon Says from Sports Info Solutions. And then I'm going to do a special 10 or 12 minutes on Jackie Robinson as well. So we've got plenty coming up. So sit back on this Saturday night and enjoy it. We've got Greatest Game coming up, of course, sponsored by Georgie Brothers. And I know Rob Georgie is listening. And we thank him for everything. So a lot to catch up with, but I appreciate everyone hanging with us on this Saturday night. I look forward to it very much. And I think it fills a big void for everybody missing baseball. So I'm glad to do it. I'm glad to have everyone part of it with me. Just be safe. All right, more coming up right after this.